Hello and welcome to The Reset, a mental health podcast without all the bollocks. I'm Sam Delaney. My guest this week is the psychotherapist Noel McDermott. Like so many people in his profession, Noel decided to train as a therapist after suffering from his own mental health problems. Having experienced PTSD, he then went into recovery for addiction issues and has been sober now for many years. Since 1996, he's been trying to help others get better. Noel's a popular spokesperson on mental health matters across the British media and has his own podcast, The Wellbeing Show, which you can find on YouTube. I was a recent guest on that show and found talking to Noel so enjoyable and educational that I immediately invited him onto The Reset. So for a change, it's Noel answering questions about his own life today. His story is very inspirational and his years of experience in counselling and therapy have filled him with all sorts of invaluable wisdom. I hope you enjoy listening to our chat. Noel, welcome to The Reset.
Thanks for inviting me on, Sam. It's good to see you again, actually.
Good to see you too, mate. So I've been on your podcast. I've read a lot about your work and so forth. But what about you, mate? How did you become interested in psychotherapy in the first place? What led you down this path?
I suppose because I needed it myself more than anything else, to be honest. Like a lot of people, I think, who get into this field. So my background as a kid, I come from, I would say lumper and proletariat Irish immigrant family, really. My mum was from Dublin. My dad was from a place not far outside of Dublin called Newbridge, which is a very pretty small town. They both came from sort of significant trauma and poverty. And my mum, definitely, her family were sort of smack bang in the troubles. Her dad was very disturbing and very disturbed guy, I would say. I didn't meet him very often, thankfully. I sort of don't have that many memories of my grandfather. And I'm glad about that when it comes down to. They came from troubled times, my mum in particular. My dad, he died recently, and I'm very grateful I was able to show compassion towards him dying. But he was a very disturbed guy, to be honest. Drank too much, violent, all that sort of stuff, really. And so it was quite a troubled childhood until my mum ditched him, and quite rightly so. I actually got involved with another bloke, Alf, my stepfather, who was a really, really nice bloke. And the second half of my childhood was much more stable with him around, actually. I liked Alf a lot. I learned a lot from him in my teen years, I think, and that was really helpful to me, sort of coming into my manhood. But I inherited some stuff from my dad around the drinking. So we were a family that drank a lot, but, you know, I stood out as somebody who had significant drinking issues, which continued for much of my adult life, really. My way out of all the troubles was school, and in particular was the arts in school, and I focused on theatre. That was sort of really, I think, what saved me in many ways. I don't want to be dramatic about it, but it was certainly allowed me to have explore different aspects of myself that were just not available in terms of my relationships at home. So I was able to explore characters and new people and keep my internal life rich and interesting. And also school. I was good at school. It was great. It was a very predictable environment, very rule-bound. I knew what I had to do to get approval. I knew what would happen, what behaviours would lead to disapproval. So it was all very predictable, unlike home, which was very messy and chaotic and unpredictable and frightening. So essentially, I spent as much time at school as possible, which just turned out to be pretty good for me in the end. And then it was the arts, actually, that led me into psychological therapies and So let's see, where was I? I went to university as an undergraduate, but my drinking and drugging got the best of me, so I didn't make it through. But I ended up moving into theatre after I got thrown out as an undergraduate, and started a career in theatre, which lasted a while. I made a living out of it, to be honest, which is unusual for theatre. And so I paid the bills, such as they were, and I ended up getting involved in community arts, community theatre, and then I started work with projects that were using the arts to help people with complex needs. And I ran out of skills. That was it. And there were quite a few people on those projects who had qualified in the arts therapies in particular. And I met a drama therapist who, truth is, I fancied her. That was the truth. And but also I thought she was pretty smart cookie around what she was doing. I thought a lot of the people I met who trained in psychological therapies were idiots, to be honest, and probably says more about me, but I just didn't understand them. They spoke in this really weird language. It was like a felt like a cult type thing. They were sort of using words I didn't understand. But this woman, she didn't. She was pretty down to earth. And we had a chat about the course she'd done. And I phoned the course up, bless them. And they said, "Yeah, we've got an open day, come along." And I went along to this open, what I thought was an open day. And I just had a laugh. I really enjoyed it. And then the bloke at the end interviewed me. I didn't realize an interview. I just thought it was a chat. He said, "So why do you want to be a therapist?" And I was like, "I don't." He said, "Why are you here?" I said, "Oh, well," and I just told him the story. Okay. And to his credit, I mean, again, it was really down to earth. And he just said, "Okay, well, what did you think of the day? What did you like? What did you dislike? What would you do if you were on the course? I know you haven't decided, but give us your views on it." And we had a good chat. And they invited me on the course. That's literally how it happened. And that could be a metaphor for my life. That's how my life happens, to be honest.
What sort of a not fully planned, but
Not
things
fully
arise
planned,
and
following
you
my
drift into
heart,
them.
dynamic, creative, that sort of stuff, you know. I'm lucky I seem to land on my feet. There you go. That's one way of saying it, I suppose.
Did you, and at that stage, had you undergone any therapy yourself?
I'd done some, yeah, a little bit, but not much. Hadn't been successful. But as part of the course, they required you to be in therapy. So I then started on a bit of a journey. And my partner at the time, my ex, as she is now, I don't know if I should admit this, but I, due to sort of the severity of the childhood, I struggled a lot with depression in particular, and as well as the drinking and stuff like that. So I was in a dark place in many ways, and I got light relief when I did theatre, to be honest. I could be other people, not me. And I was always looking to not be me because being me was too painful. And looking back, I would say I had PTSD, to be honest. And it wasn't a word. I'm old, and it wasn't really a word that we understood all that much or used in those days. This ex of mine, she said, actually, what she did was introduce me to MDMA. And I'd messed myself up on drugs as an undergraduate and avoided them. So I thought drinking would be safe. As people do, I thought it wasn't, but there you go. But she did. She introduced me to MDMA. I only ever had one tab, and I had this strange feeling on it, and this strange contorted look on my face, which just went something like this. And I wasn't used to that contorted smile thing. I didn't smile very much, and I said, "I feel really strange." She said, "You know what that is, Noah?" She said, "It's happiness." And I went, "Oh, right. I've heard tell of that strange thing." And actually, it was really interesting, and it's sort of why the drug was invented. I'm not suggesting people use it recreationally. It's a dumbass thing to do, but it was actually invented in relationship therapy, and it was invented as a tool to help people experience feelings that they had lost hold of, like love for their partner or happiness. So they're chronically depressed. And so it gave me an emotional reference point for some work I wanted to do, which was I wanted to deal. I suppose at that point I thought about getting rid of the depression. I wouldn't think about it in those terms now. But really it was to learn how to be happy. I hadn't been taught how to be happy at all. So that was, I'm very grateful to her for that, for starting me on that journey. And I would still see myself as part of that sort of, that my, one of my core goals is to continue to work in a way that I'm happy.
So it sort of gave you a glimpse of a feeling that you didn't know existed. And you thought, yeah. I wonder, oh, so that's attractive. I wonder if there are other ways that don't involve substances that I could achieve this. You'd grown up in a sense you didn't think happiness was not something you're familiar with or had an option of.
No, not at all. I mean, it was, I was really uncomfortable inside myself. And so, like, up until that point, that there might be a better alternative hadn't occurred to me. And my sort of the way I organized my life was to try to not feel, because the feelings I had were difficult and uncomfortable. And that was why I drank, really. It was to get to a numbed out state, or to shift my emotional state so it was less painful. That was it. And this sort of event gave me a sense that that there was an alternative option. And that combined with the personal therapy that I'd started and the training as a therapist began to put in place a whole bunch of stuff that was beginning to indicate an alternative sort of way of being. But it has to be said, I was still drinking, you know, far too much for any of it to really hit home. And it wasn't until I stopped drinking, which was like a decade later, that all of that stuff really made sense. But it was part of my journey, was that's how I got to the point where I could contemplate not drinking.
And how did that come about? Was that a matter of, did you hit crisis? Did you have to go through recovery, or was it?
It's interesting. I mean, the way I think about it is that, I was 41, 42 when I stopped drinking. It happened. I was admitted to a rehab in the December of 2008. And does this make sense? Yeah, I became 42. Yeah, that was it, something like that. And it hadn't occurred to me I could stop drinking because it was so normal. I've been drinking since a child, all through my adult life, and it hadn't really occurred to me that not drinking was just a simple decision I could make. It was very complicated in my head, but actually in the rehab, it was made very straightforward for me. It's just a decision, decide not to drink, and just live with that and see what happens. As it happens, I'm one of the lucky people that, although I had to be medically detoxed, and I just like to highlight that because I was highly dependent on alcohol. It's quite a dangerous drug to just suddenly stop. So if you are heavily drinking, I would suggest to people you get a medical assessment of how to stop. So, you know, they gave me some benzodiazepines for 3 days so that I didn't die of a heart attack, basically. When I woke up from that, as it were, I came off the benzies, I was happy. Literally. And it was just great for me. And there was no turning back. I'm just one of those very lucky people that I embraced being sober. And it worked immediately for me. I got immediate benefits, such as no longer wanting to kill myself. I sort of lived with these horrific thoughts for a long time. And And I told myself, and like this is after a decade of personal group therapy. I mean, I stopped, and all that stuff, that all the work I'd done, clicked into place, really. So it wasn't just simply I stopped. I mean, I'd had a decade of lots of personal work, but the drinking was maintaining an old version of myself that I kept telling myself was true. When I stopped drinking, oh, that's not true anymore. It was just like that.
Wow. So
it was, you know, and I remember day four, it was in the middle of a bitter winter, and there was ice underneath the branches of the trees, looking out of the window. And it was a beautiful sunrise caught, reflected through the ice that was lining the branches of the trees. Absolutely gorgeous. And then I got that strange feeling again that I'd had on MDMA once. Oh, and I got it without drugs and without drink. And it was just Mother Nature sort of offering me some happiness. And I, oh, right. And yeah, that was it for me in terms of not drinking. And I know I'm not going to drink again. I don't have any sort of voodoo worries about saying that. Some people get really anxious about that, but it's fine. It's been only sort of benefit to me. It's not everybody's story, but that was definitely my story that I got immediate benefits. But I got the immediate benefits, I think, because I put the work in as well. And I continued to put the work in after that. And I continued to take sensible advice. I remember this psychiatrist at this place saying to me, take these tablets. They were SSRIs. He said, take them for a couple of years and then they stop being of any use. But for the first couple of years of your recovery, take those. It'll help balance your brain out so that all the messing about you've done with it, with the various chemicals you put inside it, this will just stop you having a depressive relapse. Use it prophylactically is what he, and that made sense. And I went, okay, I'll do that. And then they also said things like, go to peer support meetings, which I did it.
Yeah.
And I did the suggestions in those peer support meetings. I didn't, you know, because I enjoyed being sober. My reference point for not being sober was horror. This was quite pleasant. And also, I have to say that although I was high functioning as a professional and all that sort of stuff, a lot of the ordinary everyday stuff around social interaction, I didn't have a Scooby about.
Right.
And yeah. So, yeah, I didn't really know how to just have a conversation with people. I overthought everything. I wasn't relaxed and comfortable in my skin, even though I was, you know, out of the suicidal thoughts and the depression, all of that lifted. But just having an easygoing life was not something I'd practiced. And the peer support groups, you know, gave me a space in which to practice all those social skills I'd missed out on, to be honest. And I found that I'm eternally grateful for that.
Yeah.
It took me away from the intensity that I was in into a much more easygoing, relaxed space, which is certainly easier going on me. And I think easier going on the people around me as well, which is, there's a win-win there.
The one of the things you're saying, that moment where you saw the light on the ice, you know, reminds me of that. I had a sort of they call it a pink cloud, don't they? A moment. I was on a train, maybe like only a week or two into my sobriety, and I was looking out at the sky and the fields and the sheep in the fields, and I got this rush of kind of excitement and wonder about it. And I always remember that moment as it. And what's similar is this idea that when people hear you talking about, oh, how great life is in sobriety, I think they often think that we've become smug and we've just become so into, like, I don't know, like something very wholesome, like, oh, I'm really into hiking now or whatever it is, you know. But the truth is, and the way you describe it so well, is it sort of suddenly opens your eyes to the things around you.
Yeah.
That are already there and are already sources of joy and pleasure, but somehow alcohol has switched you off from. And you sort of, and I don't know whether it's like a case of, do you think alcohol sort of tells us, like a controlling partner, you forget all that stuff, that's all shit. The only way you can have fun or forget your worries is with me. And then suddenly you stop and you look around and you think, Jesus, there's stuff all around me that is amazing every day.
It's interesting. I had it's an ex-supervisor of mine, clinical supervisor, who described it like this, which I think is a nice way of thinking about it. He said, relating to drugs and alcohol is relating to death. And then when you stop doing that, you start relating to life.
Mm.
And life is preferable, in my experience, to death.
Yeah.
That's all. And that stuff of, I mean, I suppose my remembrance of that time was obsessively focused on every sort of tiny detail of my internal processes was my experience of using. I was absolutely obsessed by every microsecond of experience inside me.
Mm.
And I missed everything else.
Yeah.
Now it's a much more balanced version of me, which is, yeah, I notice what's going on inside me, but I don't overly attach to it. And there's a lot of stuff outside of me that has nothing to do with me, but that brings me, you know, interest and pleasure. And there's stuff that I'm intimately connected to outside of me, like my son, for example, that brings me great joy as well as at times great fear. And but it's outside of me, and I'm not just constantly ruminating on every single. And I used to be the way I used to have this thing about relationships with people, and this is when I was still using, right? And I think of it as it was a salami slice, you know, salami slice,
yeah,
thin, a cut of tiny bits of meat, and you make that piece of sausage last forever. And I did that with my interactions with people. So I'd maybe meet somebody for literally 2 or 3 minutes, but I'd spend hours afterwards salami slicing that meeting.
Yeah.
Thinner and thinner and thinner and thinner, and obsessively going through and inspecting those slices and so for every minute detail. And that's how I lived my life. And it was like, I mean, that's not alive, is it? That's not really living a life. Because and now when I meet people, you know, I could spend hours with people in a comfortable, like I spend time with my son. There's nothing we like better than just being in the same room. And I couldn't tell you what we've done. There's no obsessive focus on it. It's just we've spent time together. We're comfortable. We're happy. He's doing his stuff. I'm doing my stuff. And we have these beautiful experiences. And he said it brilliantly once. He was, a 7 or something. Like a 7-year-old teaching me about life, but there you go. I'm not proud. I'll take it. We're on a beach and we walked off the beach and he sat down. He said, this is good. Quiet. And we sat in quiet together, me and this 7-year-old boy. We both really enjoyed it, you know. And quiet. I don't know if you haven't had quiet, if you've had a really noisy internal world, which I've had for many, many years, having a quiet one is such a gift. It really is.
Having quiet and being able to just sit there with it, I mean, certainly when I was younger and I was still drinking and using, if I'd been quiet, I would have got panicked because I would have thought, well, quiet is the moment at which the kind of thoughts, the scary thoughts start creeping in. And so my first instinct would have been, how can we fill this silence? How can we kind of, you know, liven it up? But it's a beautiful feeling when you're with someone and you can just both sit there and or be alone and do it. And it's nice. It's a nice feeling when you can notice yourself doing that and think, God, this is a big change from the old me. I can just sit here. Why do you think people, because the way that it happened for you, sobriety sounds wonderful, but like you say, you're one of the lucky ones. And I personally can relate to your experience in a lot of ways, but I also have seen a lot of mates and people I'm close to not able to sort of see all the things that you saw. What do you think from your experience of working with people, you know, are the big reasons where people don't, they can't stick with it. It doesn't work for them. What do you know, what are the reasons for that you see most commonly?
There's a lot of reasons. And I think one of the main reasons, it's not often talked about, is undiagnosed other issues. So ADHD is a big one. You see a lot of people getting treated for addiction who've actually got ADHD. They may have both. Same with autism, autistic spectrum disorder. So those types of congenital issues, you know, where people have neurodiversity or other sort of significant issues like that that are undiagnosed. And they're using substances to try and manage it, as well as a plethora of sort of the more severe mental health problems. I mean, I really admire people that manage multiple comorbidities like that. So I know a number of people who have, for example, bipolar disorder and also are managing recovery from substances, and that's complex stuff. Another major factor, I think, is undiagnosed trauma. I'm not a great fan of some of the people online who say all addiction is about trauma. No, I'm not. Whatever. But there's a significant portion of people who come from experiences that are living in sort of trauma symptoms and would benefit from really good help around that. And there's plenty of good help, EMDR, etc. So that's another major factor. I'd like with me as well, I think there's a significant cohort of people who just, you know, that they grew up in this stuff. And it's their normal, and it's really difficult to get out of think outside the box for them. And they're caught up in social, familial situations that are really difficult to break away from. I suppose the main thing I would say is that, you know, some people, it's really sad that they can't get it. And that's what it is. It's not a failing. It's just really sad. And I have a lot of compassion for them. I would also say there's other models at work which are just as valuable. So I work a lot in harm reduction and harm minimization, and that's just as valuable as abstinence-based approaches, and actually are often more successful with people that have comorbidities. So the aims and outcomes and goals shift to reducing the damage. And reducing the damage is just as good. Just as good. And it really, we shouldn't be judging this stuff in head, not that you are, but I'm just saying, making a point about it. That there are, you know, it's there's a spectrum of experience in terms of how and why people are misusing. And there's a spectrum of responses. And also I would say these days, that the way I view this stuff, particularly alcohol, is that we're looking more and more about it as a health issue as opposed to an addiction versus not addiction issue. Those of us, I would say, you know, that I need abstinence as part of my life. But it would have been interesting to see sort of if there had been effective interventions when I was younger, for example, that had suggested moderation or a health approach, and rather than an on-off, because sort of you know, abstinence-based approaches are sort of on-off. You know, you switch it off, you stay on the wagon. People talk about it. You're on the wagon. That's it. You know, and there are a multiplicity of approaches and ways of thinking about it, which are not that binary, and are incredibly valuable. So, for example, I'll give you an example of there's been a public health program aimed at young people since 2015, which has significantly reduced alcohol use problems within the population. You know, significantly reduced by looking at that. Prevention strategies and getting on the bandwagon, if you like, of health and well-being, which is out there at the moment. It's a great bandwagon to be part of, I would thoroughly. And understanding alcohol from a health perspective, as opposed to this simplistic binary addiction, alcoholism versus something else. So I'm a great advocate of those approaches and allowing people to make rational decisions, really, about
it. I mean, I could imagine had I kind of grasped that sort of stuff at a much younger age, it could have been effective for me, and perhaps I could have been a more measured, moderate drinker. But the truth is that most people only are driven to address their drinking once they hit some sort of crisis, by which stage very often moderation is sort of not really plausible.
It's not the truth anymore, though, Sam. That's the point about this new work by the government. Sorry to cut across you, but
yeah,
since 2015, we've been using a public health approach around alcohol.
Yeah.
And alcohol usage by young people in that cohort has dropped off by 20%. So it's actually, the evidence is it's actually effective. It's not effective for you and me because we're old farts, right? Yeah. And it is a progressive problem. And it's a problem that if you train your brain into something and it becomes habituated in you, it becomes part of your personality.
Right? Yeah.
That's the truth. And it's not because addictive personalities exist. You're not born with it, but you train yourself into it because of your life circumstances. But if you choose a different approach at a population level, it's really, really effective.
So it's cultural change, really, as
really
well.
Really is.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's really working. I mean, the figures are, like in Britain, the figures for smoking cigarettes and alcohol just went like that amongst people. It's amazing. They're doing incredible.
Educating people at an earlier age before things get
really
out of hand.
It works. Yeah. It's massive, the impact. And again, that's why I say these things need to be looked at in a spectrum of experience and interventions. And it's the risk for somebody like me who went past any of those moderated approaches is that I think nobody can. That's not true.
Yeah.
The vast majority of people are fine because the approaches that I'm in, and I guess you're in as well, are successful for about 10 to 12% of people.
Mm.
We tend to think, because it's successful for us, that it's successful for everybody. It's not. I mean, it's quite a niche market, to be honest.
Yeah.
And the other approaches pick up everybody else. So I think it's just really important to sort of be open to that. And then to say to people like you and me, don't be a dumbass. Just stop.
Yeah. Well, I think it's like if you're in crisis and you're past the perfect certain point, then you don't have as many options. But what is much better is if you can prevent people from ever getting to that stage. So, you know, what I'm saying is if there's people listening who feel like they might be in a crisis, that they've gone past the point at which they can control their drinking, you know, then perhaps moderation is going to be difficult to practice. But society is going to be better if we continue these public health, you know, campaigns that you've talked about, whereby a lot of us old farts like us might not have got into that. I mean, on a very simple level, we were growing up in an era where going out and getting pissed was considered perhaps the only form of like sort of entertainment, and also a perfectly legitimate and fairly harmless one. I mean,
I remember going to nightclubs.
Grew up in.
I remember going to nightclubs at 13 years old, mate, going in and getting trashed in them because my sisters worked in the nightclubs, and so I'd get in, the bouncer to let me in. Nobody batted an eyelid. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it was normal. It was absolutely normal. In some parts of the UK, it still is. But I think that normal is changing, and that's a good thing. But you're right. There's got to be a clarity about the way I think about it is this. People have the incorrect framing for asking. They ask the wrong questions of themselves. And the question around your substance misuse, your alcohol misuse, shouldn't be, is it bad enough for me to stop? Because that's more like, I think of it as a sort of beyond a reasonable doubt. You know the difference between criminal justice and civil justice. So in criminal justice sort of courtrooms, it's beyond a reasonable doubt, which is a very high bar very high bar for evidence, right? So beyond, so there's no possible reasonable doubt, but that it's the truth. What that looks like in your life is your life's a wreck. That's what beyond a reasonable doubt looks like, right? But in civil cases, it's on balance of probabilities, right? Which is a much lower evidentiary bar. Now, on balance of probabilities in these questions means that there's quite a lot of indicators that you will reach a really bad place if you keep going in the direction you're going. And that balance of probabilities are things like, well, you know, in my case, for example, yeah, it's a long history of these problems in my family. I come from a traumatic background. I come from poverty. There's abnormal drinking in my family. On balance of probabilities, if I drink under those circumstances or anybody drinks under those circumstances, on balance of probabilities is I'm going to be a real mess. Right. And so using that approach on balance of probabilities, it's a reasonable decision to stop earlier. And I know somebody who became abstinent after one night out drinking.
Wow.
Using that thinking. And they were 18 when they went into abstinence. And their balance of probabilities, so they had two parents who were in abstinence-based recovery. They went out one night drinking and were an absolute wreck, were a mess and frightened themselves with it. And they made a rational decision that on balance of probabilities, that's where I'm headed with my drinking. So I think I'll stop. 18, they just made a rational decision, stop. And the reality is that person's life and my life without drink only got better. And even with people who are not coming to those types of conclusions, there's very little to there's very little positive press around drinking. There's very little positive press. And from a health perspective, the health consequences of drinking are immediate at tiny amounts. So you massively increase your risk of cancer. Because of where drinking is consumed, you massively increase your risk of rape, violence, robbery, all sorts of things, because you're going to be out amongst people who are doing that stuff. There's a direct link between violence and alcohol because it affects people's amygdala and their threat mechanisms. So that's why there's so much violence associated with alcohol, et cetera, et cetera. So once you start looking at those broader risks, there's rational reasons why you'd stay the hell away from the stuff, which has got nothing to do with whether you're an addict at all. You don't have to wait till you're an addict. Like I ask this question, like I say to a young woman, for example, would you consider this as a possibility in your life? Going on a Friday night at 9:30, going to a pub you don't know and just having a quiet drink, would that rationally make sense to you? Or if you look at all the various risks associated to you as a young woman on your own going into pub, it's like, no, there's no way I would do that. And so once you start to look at it like that, it's like, yeah, okay, that makes sense. It makes sense to stay away from the stuff because it's pretty toxic when it comes down to it. On every level.
Just lastly, Noel, it's been wonderful speaking to you about all this stuff. Just in terms of therapy generally, this is a podcast that is aimed mainly at men, and I think a lot of the listeners are the sort of guys who might be, you know, they might feel like they're struggling, but as we know, you know, a lot of men are not hostile to, but skeptical or nervous about the idea of therapy. And they think it might not be for them. And they think it might be full of kind of psychobabble or off-putting things. What's your advice for men who might be struggling and not sure that they're ready to go and talk to a professional?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I recognize that. I identify it as I explained in my story. The reason I got into the profession, how I got into the profession, was meeting somebody who didn't babble at me.
Yeah.
And made sense and was down to earth. And so that's the first rule, is don't do it with somebody that makes you feel uncomfortable. Only do it with somebody that makes you feel comfortable. You know, that doesn't make you feel stupid and disempowered. Also, modern psychological therapies, and there's a range of them, are more about learning skills. Right, they're just not about lie down and tell me about your mum and dad. It's just not what we do anymore. And if somebody asks you to do that, get up and walk out. to be honest. Yeah. They don't know what they're doing. So modern psychological therapies are really about what's going on for you right now, what's upsetting you right now. Here's a bunch of stuff that will definitely help you almost immediately. And if somebody you go and see can't do that with you, they're probably not worth seeing, to be honest. Mm. It's called evidence-based practice. And evidence-based practice is a really effective set of therapies. There's a whole bunch of what we call modalities, CBT, EMDR, DBT. There's a whole bunch of spaghetti language stuff. But the person you see should be able to describe to you what it is they're offering, what the outcomes are, and how long it takes. And they should be able to deal with your problems right here and now. And they should be able to give you more tools in your kit bag. And that's what it's about. If you then want to go on and do some of the lie down and tell me about your mum and dad stuff, that's up to you. But it's not necessary. What's necessary is to learn how better to cope with here and now. The reality is that mental health problems like drinking are progressive problems. They don't fix themselves. It only gets worse. So on balance of probabilities, if you're struggling at this point, the chances are it's going to get worse without intervention. So you might as well get intervention now before it's a crisis, because the evidence is that for blokes, it will become a crisis and you'll end up in a dark place. So start now at the early warning signs. Improve your tools and resources for preventing something getting worse. Don't wait until the evidence is beyond a reasonable doubt, because beyond a reasonable doubt is you're in a really dark place. That's what I would say.
No, it's been a real pleasure and an education talking to you. I'm really grateful for your time. Fantastic guest. And I will include links to your wonderful podcast and all your other stuff in the show notes with this episode. Thank you ever so much for joining me on The Reset.
Thanks for inviting me on. Have a great day.
You too.
That was Noel McDermott, such a smart and inspirational bloke. You can find his show on YouTube. I'll post a link in the podcast notes. Thanks for listening to The Reset as always, gang. Remember to subscribe at samdelaney.substack.co. For £5 a month, you can get a ton of extra podcasts and content. Until next time, be lucky and don't let the dickheads get you down.